The Hits. I'm Nikki Strong.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Susan Shand, and John Russell. Later, we will present The Boarded Window by Ambrose Bierce on American Stories. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Ford Motor Company has officially presented an electric version of its best-selling F-150 pickup truck. The company showed off its new model, the F-150 Lightning, during an event this week. In announcing the vehicle, Ford Chief Jim Farley said it represented a watershed moment for the company. He added it also marked a very important transition for the automobile industry. Experts say that with its new vehicle, Ford is aiming to be highly competitive with other companies in the electric truck market, notably Tesla and General Motors. The Lightning seems to offer buyers new technology in a popular, proven vehicle that is also good for the environment and saves on fuel costs. The trucks are to be manufactured at a production center in Dearborn, Michigan, beginning next year. Ford said it was investing $700 million into the production complex and was adding 500 new jobs. It plans to start selling the vehicles in the spring of 2022. With a starting price near $40,000, the F-150 Lightning will be available in four different versions. The base model will have a traveling range of 370 kilometers on one battery charge. Ford says the size of the cab and bed of the electric vehicle will be the same as its gas-powered F-150. And with a federal tax credit of up to $7,500 available for Ford electric vehicles, the price of the base model falls to around $32,500. That is below the lowest-priced gas model of the F-150, which starts at $37,000. The company says the high-end Lightning, which is equipped with a longer-range battery, can pull an estimated 4,500 kilograms. This is comparable to many gas-powered trucks, but it falls about 1,350 kilograms short of Ford's powerful V8 engines. The F-150 Lightning comes with a 39-centimeter electronic control screen and extra storage space where the gas engine would be. Ford says the Lightning with the extended-range battery can fully power a home for up to 3 days. The high-end truck will likely cost between $60,000 to $90,000. In a usual year, Ford sells about 900,000 F-Series trucks in the U.S. The model has been America's top-selling vehicle for nearly 40 years. F-150 trucks are commonly used at building sites across the U.S. Ford expects to increase yearly production of the electric F-150 to 40,000 vehicles or more beginning in 2023. That information comes from Sam Fiorani, an expert at industry research company Auto Forecast Solutions, who spoke to Reuters. By comparison, Tesla's electric Cybertruck is set to begin high-level production in 2022, with a starting price of $39,900. GM describes its first electric pickup as an electric supertruck, the GMC Hummer EV. It will go into production in autumn of 2022 and will be priced from nearly $80,000 to nearly $100,000. While electric vehicle sales in the U.S. are rising, the overall share of the market is still very low. This year, through April, automakers sold about 108,000 fully electric vehicles in the U.S. That is nearly twice the number from the same period last year. However, auto industry researcher Edmunds reports that EVs still account for only 2% of U.S. vehicle sales. I'm Brian Lynn.
The 50th anniversary of the Spanish battle to conquer Mexico arrives on May 22nd. Some believe the battle for Tenochtitlan, the Aztec capital now called Mexico City, was the birth of modern Mexico. Others believe it was the start of a tragedy that has lasted for centuries. The battle lasted for months before the city fell to Hernan Cortes and the Spanish conquistadors, or conquerors. The battle was one of the few times an indigenous army fought European colonial powers. The fall of Tenochtitlan opened the modern history of the West, said historian Salvador Ruida. He is director of the city's Chapultepec Museum. The event is memorialized by a plaque in the city's Plaza of Three Cultures. It honors indigenous Mexico, Spanish colonialism, and the mixed-race Mexico, also called Mestizo, that came from the conquest. It was neither a triumph nor a defeat. It was the painful birth of the mestizo, mixed race, Mexico today, the plaque reads. The Mexican government has backed that idea ever since. Mexico is a non-racial, non-racist, unified nation where everyone is mixed race, bearing the blood of both conquerors and conquered. A few streets away is a different message. On the wall of the small church of Tequipucan, another plaque reads, Tequipucan, the place where slavery began. It says this is the place where the Aztec emperor was taken prisoner after his defeat. The fall of Mexico to Tenochtitlan started a tale of epidemics, abuses, and 300 years of colonial rule in Mexico, said the city's mayor, Claudia Sheinbaum. Over the next three centuries, colonizers stole the land from indigenous peoples and made them work it, taking the wealth for themselves. David M. Carballo is a professor of Latin American studies at Boston University. He said the conquest of Mexico connected the transatlantic to transpacific world and all the habited continents. That kicked off what we now call globalization. Cortes and his 900 Spanish soldiers started the battle on May 22, 1521. The Spanish army was strong and experienced. It had spent hundreds of years fighting to take back Spain from the Moors. They also brought in other indigenous peoples who were oppressed by the Aztecs to join the fight. They stopped water and food from entering the city. Their most powerful weapon, however, was the disease smallpox, which they brought with them from Spain. Against this disease, the Aztecs were defenseless. Carlo Viesca is a medical historian at Mexico's National Autonomous University. He said about 150,000 of the city's 300,000 citizens died of smallpox before the Spaniards took control. One Spaniard described it as walking on corpses, said Viesca. Because of the number of bodies and the smell of death, the Spanish could not live in the city for months. Eventually, they destroyed all the buildings to bury the dead in the wreckage. I'm Susan Shand.
Aigun writes, can you explain the words province, city, district, county, and town? What are the differences? Dear Aigun, your question centers on how a country divides itself into different levels of governance. The difference is much like the layers of an onion. Underneath a large layer, there are smaller layers beneath. There are differences between how these levels of governance look between countries. So let's only explore the United States. In the United States, we use the term state instead of the term province. A state is a part of a country that can make its own laws about some things, but it is still controlled by the federal government. The United States has 50 states, Texas, New York, California, and so on. Each of these states generally has many cities, districts, counties, and towns. A city is a place where people live that is larger than a town. Famous cities in the U.S. include New York City, Dallas, Los Angeles, Chicago. Let's talk through an example. Colorado is a state. Cities in Colorado include Denver, with an estimated population around 730,000, and Colorado Springs, with about 480,000 people. Towns in Colorado include Silverton, with an estimated population of 600, and Nucla, with around 700. A county is an area of a state that is larger than a city and has its own government to deal with local issues. For example, El Paso County, in Colorado, has the city of Colorado Springs as well as other communities inside of it. A district is an area of a country, city, or town that a government establishes for official business. In the U.S., there are school districts, voting districts, and so on. Colorado's 5th congressional district, for example, is a voting district that includes Colorado Springs and other communities. It might help to think about different levels of governance in your country. Then you can compare your country to the United States. Maps can help, as well as the news. If you have a question for our staff of teachers, send it by email to learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm John Russell.
In 1830, only a few miles away from what is now the great city of Cincinnati, Ohio, lay a huge and almost endless forest. The area had a few settlements established by people of the frontier. Many of them had already left the area for settlements further to the west, but among those remaining was a man who had been one of the first people to arrive there. He lived alone, in a house of logs, surrounded on all sides by the great forest. He seemed a part of the darkness and silence of the forest, for no one had ever known him to smile or speak an unnecessary word. His simple needs were supplied by selling or trading the skins of wild animals in the town. His little log house had a single door. Directly opposite was a window. The window was boarded up. No one could remember a time when it was not. And no one knew why it had been closed. It surely was not because of the man's dislike of light and air. Sometimes he could be seen lying in the sun on his doorstep. I imagine there are few people living today who ever knew the secret of that window. But I am one, as you shall see. The man's name was said to be Murlock. He appeared to be 70 years old, but he was really 50. Something other than years had been the cause of his aging. His hair and long, full beard were white. His gray, lifeless eyes were sunken. His face was wrinkled. He was tall and thin, with drooping shoulders, like someone with many problems. I never saw him. These details I learned from my grandfather. He told me the man's story when I was a boy. He had known him when living nearby in that early day. One day, Murlock was found in his cabin, dead. It was not a time and place for medical examiners and newspapers. I suppose it was agreed that he had died from natural causes, or I should have been told and should remember. I know only that the body was buried near the cabin, next to the burial place of his wife. She had died so many years before him that local tradition noted very little of her existence. That closes the final part of this true story. Except for the incident that followed many years later. With a fearless spirit, I went to the place and got close enough to the ruined cabin to throw a stone against it. I ran away to avoid the ghost which every well-informed boy in the area knew haunted the spot. But there is an earlier part to this story, supplied by my grandfather. When Murlock built his cabin, he was young, strong, and full of hope. He began the hard work of creating a farm. He kept a gun, a rifle, for hunting to support himself. He had married a young woman in all ways worthy of his honest love and loyalty. She shared the dangers of life with a willing spirit and a light heart. There is no known record of her name or details about her. They loved each other and were happy. One day, Murlock returned from hunting in a deep part of the forest. He found his wife sick with fever and confusion. There was no doctor or neighbor within miles. She was in no condition to be left alone while he went to find help. So Murlock tried to take care of his wife and return her to good health. But at the end of the third day, she fell into unconsciousness and died. From what we know about a man like Murlock, we may try to imagine some of the details of the story told by my grandfather. When he was sure she was dead, Murlock had sense enough to remember that the dead must be prepared for burial. He made a mistake now and again while performing this special duty. He did certain things wrong, and others which he did correctly were done over and over again. He was surprised that he did not cry, surprised and a little ashamed. Surely it is unkind not to cry for the dead. "Tomorrow," he said out loud, "I shall have to make the coffin and dig the grave, and then I shall miss her when she is no longer in sight. But now, she is dead, of course. But it is all right. It must be all right somehow. Things cannot be as bad as they seem." He stood over the body of his wife in the disappearing light. He fixed the hair and made finishing touches to the rest. He did all of this without thinking, but with care. And still through his mind ran a feeling that all was right, that he should have her again as before, and everything would be explained. Murlock had no experience in deep sadness. His heart could not contain it all. His imagination could not understand it. He did not know he was so hard struck. That knowledge would come later and never leave. Deep sadness is an artist of powers that affects people in different ways. To one, it comes like the stroke of an arrow, shocking all the emotions to a sharper life. To another, it comes as the blow of a crushing strike. We may believe Murlock to have been affected that way. Soon after he had finished his work, he sank into a chair by the side of the table upon which the body lay. He noted how white his wife's face looked in the deepening darkness. He laid his arms upon the table's edge and dropped his face into them, tearless and very sleepy. At that moment, a long screaming sound came in through the open window. It was like the cry of a lost child in the far deep of the darkening forest, but the man did not move. He heard that unearthly cry upon his failing sense, again and nearer than before. Maybe it was a wild animal, or maybe it was a dream, for Murlock was asleep. Some hours later, he awoke, lifted his head from his arms, and listened closely. He knew not why. There, in the black darkness by the side of the body, he remembered everything without a shock. He strained his eyes to see he knew not what. His senses were all alert. His breath was suspended. His blood was still as if to assist the silence. Who, what had awakened him, and where was it? Suddenly the table shook under his arms. At the same time he heard, or imagined he heard, a light, soft step, and then another. The sounds were as bare feet walking upon the floor. He was afraid beyond the power to cry out or move. He waited there in the darkness, through what seemed like centuries of such fear. Fear as one may know, but yet live to tell. He tried, but failed to speak the dead woman's name. He tried, but failed to stretch his hand across the table to learn if she was there. His throat was powerless. His arms and hands were like lead. Then something most frightful happened. It seemed as if a heavy body was thrown against the table with a force that pushed against his chest. At the same time, he heard and felt the fall of something upon the floor. It was so violent a crash that the whole house shook. A fight followed, and a confusion of sounds impossible to describe. Murlock had risen to his feet. Extreme fear had caused him to lose control of his senses. He threw his hands upon the table. Nothing was there. There is a point at which fear may turn to insanity, and insanity incites to action. With no definite plan, and acting like a madman, Murlock ran quickly to the wall. He seized his loaded rifle and, without aim, fired it. The flash from the rifle hit the room with a clear brightness. He saw a huge, fierce panther dragging the dead woman toward the window. The wild animal's teeth were fixed on her throat. Then there was darkness, blacker than before. And silence. When he returned to consciousness, the sun was high, and the forest was filled with the sounds of singing birds. The body lay near the window, where the animal had left it when frightened away by the light and sound of the rifle. The clothing was ruined. The long hair was in disorder. The arms and legs lay in a careless way, and a pool of blood flowed from the horribly torn throat. The ribbon he had used to tie the wrists was broken. The hands were tightly closed, and between the teeth was a piece of the animal's ear.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.